a warning?
There ain't nothing to worry about.
I worried that you work in an office, have children, celebrate wedding anniversaries. The world of heterosexual is a sick and boring life.
Look, this may be a drag show, but it still has to be a good drag show. If possible, a great drag show.
Yes, and just because you're 22 and hung doesn't mean you're...
Let me do this, Albert.
Fine, you're the director.
Thank you. This is a complex number full of mythic themes. The woman who is singing invented you. You are her fantasy. And suddenly, you, the fantasy, see her, your inventor, and she becomes your fantasy.
I don't think I get it. Try more gum.
Albert.
I hear you.
Thank you. I know you do. Sussex, you have to explore it. But let's start with the premise that when you see this stunning, smoldering creature, she transcends your desire to chew. She electrifies you. Something starts in your pelvis and works its way towards your heart, where it becomes heart slash pelvis.
Oh. Yes?
Coming.
What about me? What do I do? Do I just stand here like an object?
No. You do an eclectic celebration of the dance. You do Fosse, Fosse, Fosse. You do Martha Graham, Martha Graham, Martha Graham. Or Twyla, Twyla, Twyla. Or Michael Kidd, Michael Kidd, Michael Kidd, Michael Kidd. Or Madonna, Madonna, Madonna. But you keep it all inside. All right, just work on that. I'll be right back. It's looking wonderful, though.
Welcome back to the show, everyone.
Welcome back.
Another week, season six. I'm so glad that we're talking about this movie.
We got to a really big one. A movie that I'm kind of shocked that we did not do in the first 10 episodes of the show.
I feel like we've taken a lot of requests over the years.
Sometimes you got to hold the big ones.
Well, let me tell you, last night as we were watching this movie, for a little recap, I LOL'd several times. This movie still slaps. Listeners, you're welcome. My name's Pete.
And I'm Scott.
And these
are the movies that made us gay.
Yes, indeed.
Welcome to the show. Former guest and friend of the pod, Blake Knight, is on today. And for the first time on the podcast, welcome Garrett Clayton, his husband.
Hello.
To the show.
Welcome to the show, gentlemen.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me back and having Garrett on. We're so excited.
Yeah, I love this movie.
Oh, great. We're so glad. We both love this movie. I feel like a lot of people do. This movie's really important, and it's so fun. Scott has some paperwork about the movie that we can get out of the way at the beginning, and then we'll start talking. What do you got?
We finally got to our Birdcage episode, directed by Mike Nichols, screenplay by Elaine May, based on the play La Cage Folle by Jean... How do you pronounce his name?
Your guess is as good as mine.
Yeah, Jean Poiret.
Based on the play La Cage Folle by Jean Poiret, which was also adapted into a 1978 film. Yes. And this movie was released March 8th, 1996. Oh my God, we got to our Birdcage episode.
Yes. So
very
funny.
Important movie to talk about on the show. I'm glad that we held it specifically for you two. As well.
Wait, I thought you guys had already done this.
No.
You haven't done this?
We have not done this movie.
You've done
over
seasons, are you sure you haven't done the Birdcage?
Six seasons, over 200 episodes, and we have been holding the Birdcage.
Wow,
for
what an
this
honor.
Long.
So, and did you like hold I said, it because this is destined to be me and Blake?
Yeah, well, we just thought that Masters of the Universe is more important to gay culture than this movie. So,
well, that's valid in other ways, yeah.
Well, I feel like we were talking for a while that we wanted to have you both on the show. And you had mentioned The Birdcage a while back. So I was just like, all right, I'm making a mental note right now. The Birdcage of when Blake comes on with Garrett. And here we are today.
Oh, awesome. I'm so excited. I thought that you had done it once and we were just doing like a recap. So that's even better.
I am honored that you saved this movie for us.
Oh, well. No better two people to talk about it with. Let's get into, at the top of the show, we usually talk about our history with the movie. If we have memories of the first time that we saw it, how it was brought to us. So I will let you two kind of take it away and go back in time to your earliest memories of The Birdcage.
And, you know, you did say no two better people to do this movie with. I think that's probably true because I would say I am the Armand in our relationship. And you're definitely a mix of the the Nathan Lane character and Agador Spartacus. I think he's a little bit of both. I'm the one who's always like, pull yourself together. And he's trying on wigs and, you know, things in the background of whatever's going on.
We've actually done, I came home drunk from a bar one night.
Haven't we all?
It is very Birdcage-esque where I was very dramatically like, everything is horrible. And he shook me and I was like, don't hit me.
I literally grabbed his shoulders because we had roommates at the time and he was having a meltdown at like 2 a.m. and just dramatic queer mess. And I was like, pull yourself together. You're going to wake up the whole house.
Living your story in fantasy.
You actually have an interesting story about the Birdcage with kind of your professional career.
Well, I saw this with my mom for the first time because she, anything with Robin Williams was my whole, like, growing up, everything. Yeah. We were big Robin Williams people in our house. And so this movie, of course, was one that me and her watched together a lot. Surprise, surprise, I'm a homosexual. And in my first acting class, this was the scene I did with my acting partner. I was in a dual enrollment program in my senior year in high school. And so I was taking performance classes at the college nearby. Mm-hmm. And I did the don't pierce the toast. It was the first...
That's funny.
First scene work I'd ever professionally done.
not telling.
And in that scene, were you, in fact, Armand, or were you Albert?
Oh.
You take it down.
For sure, Albert. For sure.
Okay.
Whenever I find myself really overreacting something and, like, throwing a fit, I do think of this scene that I really shouldn't go to pieces when I pierce the toast. I think of this scene every single time I have a crazy overreaction to anything.
It is a gay idiom that we should all take to heart, for sure.
I mean, it was... The pierce the toast line, I feel like it was in TV spots. It was in the trailer. My college friends at the time, my straight college friends, were all just screaming, I've pierced the toast. Like, it just became part. It was so funny, you know, and just seeing Nathan Lane. And that's the thing about this movie is that, like I was saying, we watched it last night and we were laughing out loud.
It still hits.
The whole time. It was so good. They're so good. Everybody in it is perfectly spot on. Cast. And I mean, I don't know. I'm ready to get, you know, I'm ready to throw myself under the bus here, but we have not seen the original French version, La Cage aux Folles.
Yeah, shockingly.
So for us, this is kind of what we're, you know, this is our version of it. So unfortunately, we won't be able to compare and contrast too much, but I just think that this script with this cast is like pitch per, it can't get any better than everybody together in this movie.
And it still holds up so well. The humor, the writing and everything is it's so sharp and spot on.
Right.
You know, there are a lot of comedies you can go back from that era now almost, you know, 20 years ago? 20 years ago? 20, where are we? Five,
over 25.
26 years, yeah.
Yep.
26 years ago, yeah. And, you know, it still holds up so well because there are so many movies from that time that were considered great comedies at the time, and now you watch and you're like, it's either cringy or not PC or something. But, you know, there are a few moments in this that probably wouldn't be a few lines in this that may not be said today. But for the most part, it's just so funny.
Right.
And you mentioned too the writer, Elaine May. She's now 91 years old.
Collaborator of Mike Nichols too. They had, I mean, I think that they pretty much started out together.
It seems like it. Yeah, I was looking at her filmography, and she'd done a lot of really awesome movies.
I think
they actually just had La Cage, which La Cage aux Folles was based off of, which is this movie was. I mean, the line of what was made from what is crazy.
It's the multiverse of
it. Really is of musicals, but they just put La Cage back up at the Roosevelt all last year.
Oh.
And now that property is like circulating in live performances again.
Oh, that's
and
great.
It's not the musical that was made. It's what the musical was based off of.
Okay.
I always just think of season one of Real Housewives of Beverly Hills where Camille Grammer, I think, says La Cage aux Folles about 20 goddamn times per episode because she's talking about Kelsey doing it on Broadway. And they have a whole episode where they go, but she, I just remember her always name dropping it. Like, she did it, I think, that Kelsey, oh, well, you know, Kelsey's on Broadway doing doing the Kasha Fall right now.
So, I mean, this brings up an interesting conversation that maybe we can get to a little bit later, but something like a property like this maybe made today, would we allow, you know, a straight actor like Robin Williams to take on this role? Would we allow? Would it be looked on a certain way, right?
Right.
I know somebody like Hank Azaria, we were talking about, like, what is Hank Azaria's heritage? Because
I looked up, he is half Spanish.
You know, because he can't exactly play Apu anymore, but, you know, we're digging him as Agador Spartacus, and it's so funny. And I, as a Latin person, am laughing at it and don't really care too much, but it's a whole thing. The other part of that conversation is Nathan Lane still in the closet in the 90s playing this role. And we as America were just like, sure. What an actor.
A movie about coding, too. Yep.
True. Well, and I wonder, it didn't seem like it really impacted his career in a largely negative way, but I wonder if he's talked about that, because even, you know, like Rupert Everett, a year after this movie came out, was in My Best Friend's Wedding. Mm-hmm. And he talked about how he wished that he hadn't done that movie because he didn't get any roles for over a decade.
Because
he played this queer character, you know? Well, so, yeah. Times have changed a lot.
Absolutely. I mean, I've seen recent kind of a story from Nathan Lane talking about going on Oprah to talk about this movie. And Oprah kind of like, he was really afraid that she was going to question him, and she kind of did. And he was really worried about how to answer it. And Robin kind of jumped in there and kind of steered the conversation away from that. And it's just a really touching story about him talking about Robin really kind of defending him when he told him ahead of time, like, I'm not ready to talk about this. Like, so, you know, I don't know what's going to happen out there. And Robin kind of took the reins, but it is an interesting conversation in that.
I saw that too, and I thought that was a really awesome, you know, just story about Robin Williams' character. And, you know, to go back to what you said before, would a straight actor today be allowed, you know, socially to play a character like this? I think it would depend on the actor, and, you know, I know that we definitely want to allow queer actors as many roles as possible, but if it was kind of this powerhouse comedic, like, you know, I know Jim Carrey's played a queer character in the past and been called out for that in a negative way. Mm-hmm. But if it is somebody who really does have the chops and can pull it off and tell a heartfelt story that allows people to connect with queer characters where they may not have even met a queer person in their real life, I think that's great.
Well, there's also something about Robin's characterization, Robin's portrayal in this movie, in that, like, I feel like I know that type of gay guy. You know what I mean?
Yep.
That certain, like, certain age, boomer, homosexual, who is just with the gold ring, the gold jewelry, and just,
like,
you know,
they were pretty much always living in a glass closet. I mean, and when you're running the birdcage, I think that you just have to live your best life in the mid-90s.
Right. But I think that Robin, as a straight person, was able to play it so well without kind of turning it into a caricature. You know, he did some like flamboyant things here and there with the portrayal, but it was never from a place
of natural, felt organic.
And so to me, I always was like, wow, what a kind of amazing job he did at playing this very specific type of gay man. And it's not just the, like, hey boys, hot stuff coming through, you know. It was a very like nuanced portrayal, and I loved it.
And I think that I was reading that, I mean, I think that he was initially offered Albert and he deliberately didn't want that, just because he had just done Mrs. Doubtfire. And he didn't want to, he just didn't want to feel like he was repeating himself or kind of getting himself in the drag box.
Right.
So he opted to go with Armand.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's a smart choice, though. I mean, I feel like for his position in the world at that time, and even today, like, casting in those roles, are you a friend or family in the community, you know? And I think a lot of grace is given to those who are organically supportive of the queer community. And so if you're cast in something like that, it feels like you're putting someone you love into something, as opposed to, like, you know, someone's polarized against our, you know, like, our rights or the way we live, then they shouldn't be in things that portray us.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. And I wonder if it had to do with him, you know, living up in Sausalito near San Francisco. I'm sure he had queer friends and he's been in the industry for decades. Right. So, yeah, it seemed like he kind of knew more, and he was just a very empathetic person, you know?
Yeah.
I was reading that Nichols originally wanted Robin Williams and Steve Martin as Albert and Armand, and Steve Martin was just like, I just don't really think this role is for me.
I could not imagine Steve Martin in this role.
Yep.
Well, I think that probably would have been with Steve as Armand, I think, and Robin as
right.
Albert. I think that's what that thought process might have been.
And just what a huge break for Nathan Lane at the time. I mean, I can't think off the top of my head how many major Hollywood movies that he could be the co-lead for. I was reading that he was supposed to be doing a funny thing, happened on the way to the forum, and they postponed it with Scott Rudin just so he could do this movie.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Whoa. Amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and not to go off on too much of a tangent, but have you guys seen Dix the Musical? That he
not yet. It's on our list. It's bookmarked.
Friend of the Pod Oscars in it.
Oh, is it Oscar Montoya?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Work. All right. We've had Oscar Montoya on the show.
We need to see it.
Oh, okay, nice. Yeah. It's a really, really wild ride. I feel like it goes off the rails in the best of ways,
sure.
But it starts pretty grounded, and then you're like, what the fuck is going on?
They nailed it. And, you know, I also I feel like, because, you know, putting Nathan Lane in this hit really led into the right direction with the producers. Like we've gotten so many amazing performances from him. I feel like, cause this movie really set him up to do characters, you know, and just like, what a great character actor. Mm-hmm. I always am in awe of his ability.
Oh yeah. Like in the Gilded Age where he does his Foghorn Leghorn. That's Foghorn Leghorn impression.
Yeah, I still haven't gotten to the Gilded Age yet. I've heard it described as like Saturday morning cartoons for gay people.
It is. Yeah, that's accurate.
I need to see it.
He said it is.
Mm-hmm.
The stakes are pretty low. And
well,
it's
the first season, it was like, let's be really dramatic, but don't you fucking let anything happen. And then the second season, you know, they took the note because they're like, everything has to happen really fast.
Yeah, yeah.
Love it.
But we digress.
Yes, yes. But I mean, this is saying kind of a lot for, you know, the time period. I think a lot of younger people these days are just like, oh, I long for the 90s. Like I was born in the wrong decade and all that. It was not really great for gay people, for queer people in the 90s. Like I was a teenager in high school in the 90s and it was not a fun time. But we were making strides, right? This movie comes out. And like I said, my college straight guy friends are laughing and quoting it, right? And I think maybe Robin had a lot to do with it because he was okay to watch this movie, but Nathan kind of showed, wow, this is a great character. 3 years later, we have Will and Grace on TV in our living room, and our parents are watching it and laughing.
Groundbreaking.
So,
and also, I mean, this is Mike Nichols. This is like the director of The Graduate.
Yeah, screenplay. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. And it shows, you know, it shows. And even in the direction and just everything that was done, it's very cinematic, even though it basically all kind of takes place for the most part in one building.
Yeah. How they transform, how Bo Welch, the production designer, married to Catherine O'Hara. How Bo Welch, I mean, he was nominated for an Oscar for this movie, and it's a contemporary movie that was nominated for Best Production Design, which is really cool because that does not happen a lot. But just how they transform that space, like how they flip it, it's so cool.
Yeah. That crazy apartment that is like, the set for that apartment is wild. I remember
that was its own character. It was its own character, and it had to be because of the way that it was built into the story.
You know, and I remember watching this movie as a young man and being like, oh my God, like with the statues and the penises and the art and all that stuff. And here I am looking around my apartment and I'm like, there's a lot of dicks in this apartment.
There's a lot of butts. I mean, there's a lot of butts as art in our apartment. If like my sister ever brought her kids, I would definitely have to like
take a few things.
I would have to take a few things off the walls.
Like, don't go to the bathroom for a minute and don't open that drawer.
That is hilarious. It's your version of the dishes, the dishware.
Yes.
playing leapfrog.
Yeah. But I do remember the first time seeing this movie and kind of never really like understanding that drag queens exist, obviously, but not really understanding what a drag show was or a drag performance or a cabaret performance and being like, oh, okay, they're not really singing. They're like lip syncing to this song and all of that. But it's interesting that like in like 90s gay movies where they're drag queens, like all these queens in this movie, like they're not cinched. They're definitely not tucked.
Like, well, I'm assuming
wearing,
that
like beauty makeup. Well, they're not wearing like drag makeup.
And
like,
I would assume that a lot of the queens from the opening numbers
are real drag queens.
I would assume that they're just queens working out of Miami,
right?
Too.
So oh, I'm sure. Yeah, yeah, local hires.
So I don't know if that's just something of the time. That I know nowadays, drag is a lot more the quote unquote realness factor is so much more prevalent nowadays. But in a pre-drag race world, I think it's so much like they were so much more clockable. And I was like, I wonder if that's a conscious effort from the filmmakers to be like, we need people to understand that these are men.
I don't know. I don't know. I think it is. There has been a major evolution in drag that kind of the gold standard that a lot of people think of nowadays is who can be the fishiest,
right?
You know, pass.
I don't know. Yeah. I feel like with the way RuPaul has set everything up and the, you know, it used to feel more like there was a lane that they would have drag in, and you know, because they have like camp queens, they have fishy girls, they have like now
pageants.
I feel like there's such a spectrum of what, like, because drag can be so many things and so many forms of art that maybe we're seeing more of like, but nowadays we have such a variety because there's so much more exposure to it, whereas before it was like, here's a subculture and here's the way that they accepted it at the time, and now it's like, be any version of it you want to be. Just be your most fabulous version that you want.
Yeah,
yeah.
That's
but
true.
They were walking down the runway and they were not tucked. I'm sure Lesage would have something to say about it.
Right.
But we still love it for this movie, for sure.
Yeah, and like Starina, like at her most glamorous, it's not like an illusion face. It's pretty much just beauty makeup on Nathan Lane, right? It's
my mom and I, because of Starina in that rehearsal scene, all the time we'll just I when I'm home, you can be anywhere in the house, and if anything goes wrong, it's he's chewing gum.
You're wasting your gum.
So good. But see, that's such a great thing too, showing Starina or Albert rehearse in
blocking
heels, you know, and like because it's, well, that's how you're going to perform. So, and I keep having to like remind myself, this is a very pre like Drag Race world, right? So this is all so foreign to just a general movie going.
Okay. Movies. And just kind of getting the timeline of major drag movies from the 90s. Mm-hmm. So it was Priscilla, Tu Wong Fu, The Birdcage, right?
And I'm not sure. Is that right? In that order?
I think Tu Wong Fu was the year before. Or no, Priscilla was the year before Tu Wong Fu, I think. That I'm assuming that probably, I mean, Mike Nichols probably had this movie set up with United Artists for a number of years going into the 90s. Sure. So, yeah. But I mean,
yeah, that's right.
I mean, Priscilla was a pretty big sleeper hit in the States. I mean, it led to the unofficial remake that Universal did.
Right, right. Yeah, it was 94, 95, 96, and it went Priscilla, Tu Wong Fu, and then Birdcage.
Well, and you know what's interesting too, I think about this movie, this movie was probably, I don't remember the first time that I saw it, but I do remember that my mom was like laughing her head off about it.
Yeah.
And I think it probably was one of the first times I had seen a drag queen, probably. Right. But I don't think I would have been allowed. I mean, Priscilla obviously is rated R. Mm-hmm, there's a lot more going on there, and it's a lot more in depth. So I probably wouldn't have been allowed to see that. But this, I think, was more of a soft opening for young queers around the country.
Yeah, yeah. I think because Robin Williams and Mike Nichols and all of that, it was a little bit more general audience. Because yeah, like you said, Priscilla is the most edgy for sure. Tu Wong Fu, I mean.
Major movie stars.
It has major movie stars, but I still feel like it was a little bit more on the independent side. And then this one is
I mean, it was
Robin
Williams. It was a major movie from Universal, Pete.
Right.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
I mean, it made a pretty good I think it made pretty good money in 1995.
Wow. Yeah. Okay.
A tie.
And I do remember seeing it like on the boxes at Blockbuster, walking down the aisles. I remember seeing it and being like, oh, that looks interesting, as like a young queer boy walking through.
I miss Blockbuster. That was so
that's the
now,
guy.
Course.
That's
so
the
fun.
Guy from Ghost and Dirty Dancing? All right. There's a movie that we still have not done on the show. Speaking of like
what?
Giant movies, like giant gay tent poles that we have not done, we have not done a Tu Wong Fu episode.
Oh, did you do Priscilla yet?
No.
We did a commentary track for Tu Wong Fu, but it's a bonus episode on our Patreon.
Oh, okay.
So you
nice,
can
nice.
Watch, you can listen to us as we're watching it, but we haven't done a like full critique.
I was thinking long term. You have to save, absolutely, big ones.
Yeah.
You're not wrong. That's good. That's very smart.
So,
also about Agador Spartacus, didn't he make up the accent?
Yeah, I think so.
Probably. Right. There's a lot of real things in there that ring true to like a lot, but it is a very kind of like wide cast net of like Latin.
Yeah. I feel like I remember reading something about him having made up the accent.
Yeah.
I was told different things. So that way it was never
sure
like one specific culture. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It sort of sounds like Hank's gay character that he plays in The Simpsons, but not really though. Yeah. Because like
I do love when he says my Guatemalan-ess.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Just not wearing shoes. Some of the dialogue, the beige native. Oh my god. All of the dialogue. But that's the thing about, you know, we haven't even talked about Gene Hackman and Diane Wiest. I mean, Gene Hackman is so funny in this.
Gene Hackman, which I appreciate about this character, is that he's not really a traditional villain. Like, you can never bring yourself to hate this character, which says a lot of the screenplay then.
But
that's true.
Some of the dialogue when, you know, when Albert Starina comes in and now he's pretending to be the wife, and he's saying all of these right-wing things to get, you know, Gene Hackman to kind of fall in love with him. So it's so wild and it's so outrageous, and it's like, well, we shouldn't kill the abortion doctors, let's just kill the mothers, and we're going to kill the baby anyway. But it's like, here we are 28 years later, and it's like, have we gotten farther away from this? No,
the Republican Party is just as rotted now.
None of this stuff is surprising.
Well, I mean, and the interesting thing about this movie too is it does show, you know, two different sides of the same coin, and it shows that there is some kind of way to bring people together, which I think is really nice. But you're right in that, you know, Gene Hackman, he's not a traditional villain, and good on him for doing this role and doing it in the way that he did at this time in the mid-90s, because I'm trying to think of other roles and things. I guess he kind of branched off. He wasn't always just like hard and fast, like straight man in both senses of the word.
Right.
And also kudos to him for the end of that movie when he's like elderly Marilyn Monroe exiting.
We were talking about that wig on his head. We were like, that looks so good.
It was a good it was a good hair proportion for his face too.
For his proportionizing that wig was like spot on. We loved it.
Well, he'll do it for Mike.
It was probably his first time in any kind of drag something, and he was like, if I'm gonna do it, this wig's gonna look good.
We'll do it right. Yeah.
And also, I mean, he'll do it for Mike.
For Mike Nichols, yeah.
He'll do it for Mike Nichols.
Yeah. And but we also love Diane Wiest and her like biker lady, like biker lesbian like drag looks so good. Okay, we have been talking about how spot on this casting is, but can we talk a little bit about Calista Flockhart and Dan Futterman as the 20-year-old?
This relationship and these characters are probably the most wild of the movie, in my opinion, of when like revisiting this movie now.
She is... At one point in the movie, he says she's 18, but earlier on, he says you're not even 18. When she first says, in the scene where she first, when we first meet them, and she's talking about getting married, and they're having their little meltdown. I think the first thing he says is you're not even 18, or maybe he said you're barely 18, something like that.
Right, right.
Oh my god.
Meanwhile, Calista Flockhart was 35 when she.
She was in her 30s.
Yeah,
when she shot this movie, they're fine. It's fine. I'm not age shaming anyone, but and Dan Futterman, by the way, listeners,
Oscar nominated screenwriter Dan Futterman.
Yes.
Yep,
he wrote Capote.
And Foxcatcher.
Yes,
that's right.
Also Oscar nominated for both. Right.
Yep.
Yeah. How cute to see in this movie.
Val is also the. I mean. Val's also kind of the villain of the movie.
You know, there's some times when you're just like, God damn it, Val. Yeah. Just like, get your shit together.
I actually really dislike him and the character, not him.
Right.
Like, I genuinely get mad. I get so upset when he's like constantly just...
Yeah, he's like, can we bring in a straight man, like maid for the night or whatever he says, that sort of thing.
Or he's like, can you just be less? And it's like all these things that I'm like, oh, God, that is so... If my child said that to me, I'd be like, this isn't who I raised. I don't care how old you are. Go in a timeout, you fucking asshole.
Right. And you know when... Okay, granted, it's like you have two gay dads. Okay, yes.
Yeah.
And Armand is your biological father. Yes. But if they raised him, he has never even met his real mother. So they raised him from a baby. This isn't just like, oh, Armand and Albie just got together. And when Albie's there looking so sad and he's just like, so when are you leaving town?
Yeah.
Get out of this house.
I wonder, was there something in the plot? Was there that Albert didn't come in until like later on, or was it since like, like he was a baby?
It always read to me that they've been together that long. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it makes it even worse when he's just like, so you're leaving town, right? Get out.
But you also have to think, you know, even today, because I work with a lot of students and a lot of my students have queer parents, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that some of them, I know one of them in particular right now, goes to a public high school here in the Valley and has friends that are very Republican.
Sure.
The parents are very Republican and very Trumpy, and the kid will not tell the friends that the parents are gay.
Right.
You know? So I think there is still, especially back then in the mid 90s, early 90s, I'm sure there was a big stigma. But you would think someone, Val, however old he's supposed to be, 20, 35, would know better than to treat his.
This also, I feel like, kind of shows like a weird normalcy of like, oh, you can be mean to your parents and it's always okay.
Yeah.
I think there's a weird normalcy in America about that.
That's true. That's true.
I mean, this movie is kind of, it's a film about what we do for our children, is that Armand is kind of sacrificing his values and character for his kid for like an evening.
Yeah.
Which is kind of an interesting conversation, especially with a gay parent. I mean, let alone set in the 90s too. Yep.
Yeah.
I mean, I know the circumstances of the, you know, the scandal with the senator and all that is kind of leading them to this dinner. But I'm just like, can't they just meet at a restaurant and like, here's my father, my mom's out of town. I don't know.
Yeah.
It does seem so much more simple than redecorating the house.
Yeah. Yeah.
But definitely not as funny.
Absolutely. When he comes out and says, who put the Playboys in the bathroom? And the one... The one queen is on the ladder and she looks over and she goes, it's what they read.
It's what they read. and it's fun for like continuity for these, like, I mean, for all the queens in the show is that they're all like helping to flip the house. So it's fun to see them brought back in. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But yeah, she's in the show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's in the show later. Yep. We clocked that was the same one that said, it's what they read.
Oh, nice. That's awesome.
Yeah.
So if it was the local hire, good for them. Maybe they got their sack part out of it.
There you go. There you go.
I have a question. Do you two have any, like, have you ever been to Miami?
Yeah.
So,
are there that many men in Speedos just walking down the street?
There that many men walking around in thongs? Because there's a lot of thongs in this movie.
I think it depends on what beach you're at.
Sure.
And this
I mean, look, even in Scarface, there are men walking around in Speedos. I don't know if it was at the time or what.
I still see men in Speedos, and I'm like, my thighs would eat that alive.
These men in this movie, they're thongs. They are G-strings. These men are walking around like, whoa, cakes out.
But yeah, I'm always
not feel confident in that.
I'm always very fascinated just with Miami because we watch episodes of The Real Housewives of Miami, and it seems like a different country down there. Like
it really seems like a
totally different part of the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It really does. I mean, even aesthetically, you know, not the people, but even the architecture and everything, it does look like a completely different place. I think that's why so many people love to go visit, you know, and vacation there too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's so funny. The location lends itself so well to the circumstances of the script because when she's, you know, when Calista Flockhart is talking to them and she's like, oh, they're in South Beach or whatever. And Diana Weiss says, oh, is that like Palm Beach? Like,
yeah, no. They're at Mar-a-Lago. Yeah, don't worry about it.
Yeah.
I do like her character in this. She seems so, I mean, like really welcoming and happy. Like she's so happy about like marrying into having, you know, two like gay parents.
Yeah. She does play off this kind of naivete really well, you know,
but it seems so earnest that she's so excited about like joining a family that's so welcoming no matter where you come from or you know what I mean, how you express yourself.
I mean, living a life growing up with your father being this conservative senator probably
well, look, I went to college with this guy whose dad was a pretty big politician in the Southwest, I'll just say.
Name him.
And first and last name.
And he was extremely gay. Like, he was the Jack McFarland of my graduating class, love basically.
It. Love it.
And, like, hooked up with all kinds of guys, whatever. He, when he graduated, though, because of his dad's political career, and I don't know if he ever intends on getting into that or what, but he got married to this girl from
somewhere in the world,
from somewhere in the world, wow, who had just kind of come to America. And I don't think really understood the nuances of like how he spoke and his behavior and all that, and just didn't register that he was gay at all. And I was like, hello. And now they have two kids.
Wow.
So what you're saying is this guy's Grindr profile probably doesn't have a face on it.
probably not
just a torso. Wow, yeah, that's wild. But no, but you're right about the Callista character. Like, I really love the moment when, I mean, it's just a funny moment when Nathan Lane drops out of frame and comes back up and the wig is crooked, and you know, she runs to the bathroom with them and she's just like, we're gonna fix this right now. And you don't get the feeling that it's to protect like her family, like it's to protect them. Like, she's like, she's part of this family now, right? Like you were saying.
Yeah.
She's very excited to join this.
And that dinner scene, the whole dinner scene is so insane.
It's so amazing. I love it.
Peasant stew.
Oh my God, the stew.
It's like a stew, it's a meal. There's no main course.
I can't wear thewth.
When he is shuffling around in those shoes so he doesn't fall down. Yeah. Oh my God. Dead. Dying. Brilliant. Dead. Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I'm a sucker for physical comedy. Yeah. And this really gives it to me on every level.
It delivers for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I always know, we haven't even spoken about Christine Baranski.
I know. I know. I always feel like her character is so like minor in this.
Yeah.
But she really, I don't know. She really has some good scenes in there.
She has some good scenes, and also just, you know, a queer icon in general. So yes. I was so happy. Yes. When she does pop up, mm-hmm. I almost every time I forget that she was in it. And then I'm like, oh my God, this just got even better than it was.
Yeah.
Fifth Christine Baranski movie that we've talked about on the podcast.
Oh, interesting.
Mamma Mia, Birdcage, Cruel Intentions, Chicago, and Addams Family Values.
Okay.
Oh my God. All amazing.
Yeah. All bangers.
Wait, she's in Addams Family Values?
Yeah, she's camp director.
Oh, that's right. Doy. Okay.
Yeah. Don't we wish they would just die? She's always fantastic.
No, we don't. Oh man. Yeah, no, she's such an icon, and so perfectly cast. I think her chemistry with Robin Williams is so great. And absolutely.
And her like 90s Miami power office it's just so of the time, and it's just set, you know, it's all those wavy glass bricks and everything, and she's running this, it's so crazy.
The receptionist reading Nietzsche.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yes.
I do feel like we were robbed of getting Christine Baranski, Robin Williams, like duo movie.
Yeah. I feel like they could have.
I mean, they have a whole backstory together because she was briefly, well,
you're talking about the characters?
Like the characters.
Yeah. Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
I meant like in real life.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Just them together, like headlining.
Whole other movie would have been.
I would have loved a whole movie with them just doing shit.
Yeah. Totally. Solving mysteries.
Whatever it is. Whatever. He, you know, he played robot, he played reversed age, rapid age.
Yeah, yeah.
Give it to us, Robin.
Yeah,
that's
come
true.
On, come on.
That's true.
I feel like there's a like a mini subplot in this movie of the like National Enquirer guys. That maybe is not as paid off as it could be, but it's kind of like, who cares?
One of these National Enquirer guys, we were talking of that. You saw this actor everywhere.
What was his name?
The skinny one. Yeah.
The skinny one.
He was in a lot of disaster
movies. He was in like Dante's Peak.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not in Twister, but he's in Godzilla, I think. But yeah, I kind of felt like at the end, I was like, could they have paid that off a little more? I don't know, but we don't like them because they're kind of giving away where the senator is, but they're also moving.
Well, the only way to really pay off their hatefulness is like to expose the family. It's hard to I mean, depending on how they wanted the plot to go, but
right, right. Well,
you know, I do. I think it's like we were talking about before, how the Kevin Keeley character was not a villain, the Gene mm-hmm. Hackman character, not a villain. Val, not really a villain, just kind of a product of the times, right,
right, right, right.
And I feel like that's kind of how it was with these National Enquirer characters too. They, you know, they were trying to out and expose this situation, but 10, 20 years ago before when this movie was made, they probably would have been straight up, you know, villains that
right.
really did something shitty. But I think it was a shift in, you know, the society and culture in America yeah. that where queer people were starting to be more respected and accepted, you know, a little bit too. Because I think, you know, you look back at, there's always gay villains going all the way back to the 40s, I think, yeah. with Laura, yeah. you know, that sort of thing.
I did feel like they were kind of being played as a little bit of an underdog because they were from the Enquirer and all of the network people sure. were kind of like trailing them.
Well, also,
so you're like, should I be rooting for them?
Well, also, this was Pete, do you remember us watching that National Enquirer documentary a few years ago? Ooh, and they God. Go into the progression of the National Enquirer kind of being yeah. a celebrity gossip newspaper, and then in the 90s they started to get into politics,
right, right.
And that was like a huge game changer for that magazine, because they, like, I mean, especially like in the late 80s, who's the guy that ran against Bush?
Dukakis.
Yeah. Didn't they break that whole story with yeah. the affair?
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, but yeah. So it was this yeah. kind of a weird transitional time for the National Enquirer that they were getting away yeah. from celebrities and going more towards right. politics.
But I'm, yeah.
They're getting away from, like, did Michael Jackson have this alien baby?
Right, right.
Yeah. Towards, yeah. yeah.
But did you also, there's so many, like, publicist stories mm-hmm. of the National Enquirers where, in real life, they... If you ever want a story buried about a client, you release it to the National Enquirer.
Oh, okay.
Because once they report on it, everyone thinks it's a lie. So
got it,
there's actually so many true stories in the Enquirer, but it's buried in all these other crazy ones. So you sure. never know what's real.
That's interesting.
That doc was really yeah. interesting, especially when they interviewed the reporters. They said that it was easier to tell people at the time that you went to prison than tell people that you wrote for the National Enquirer.
Like to get another job.
To like yeah. get another job of that. It was just so
locked
down. It was so like looked yeah. down upon in just journalists when you wrote for the Enquirer. Yeah.
Well, it's like now we have TMZ, which is so sensationalized, but TMZ yeah. so often gets things right. Like they break stories, I mean, like celebrity deaths, I mean, and things
they
like
have,
that.
They have those hot sure. tips from like the sheriff's department, probably.
Yeah. Right. So it's so weird that like TMZ, I feel like they're kind of maybe a more
legit
outlet, but they're also a contemporary of what the Enquirer and the Star kind of were in the 80s and right. 90s. It kind of that turned into.
And in a similar vein, have you guys ever seen the short-lived series due to the writer's strike, Dirt, Courtney Cox?
With Courtney Cox, yeah. I remember it. I yeah. think I remember watching a few episodes when it was airing. Yep.
We watched it a few years ago, and you know, that was the height of like Paris Hilton and Lindsay Lohan mm-hmm. like falling out of cars with their crotches yeah. out and everything. And and it was actually a really cool show, and I wish kind of that it would have kept going. But you
know. Oh my God, it was such a good show. It only got snuffed because of the writer's strike.
Yeah. Sure. Okay.
The first writer's strike yeah. in 2007, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Right, right.
But yeah. I mean, we stand a tabloid news outlet. I've told the story on the show before. My grandmother had a subscription to the National Enquirer.
Oh my gosh!
The '80s and the '90s.
I remember seeing that on the counter when I first met you, and going over to your mom's house and being like,
"Oh my
I will be thumbing through this."
Yeah, when my I'm mom over would here. Go and get the old ones and bring them back. And my mom, to this day, as long as I can remember, People Magazine always had a yeah. subscription. Not quite the Star. But one of our good friends who used to do our hair before she moved to Texas, she always had the Star, like uh-huh. at the salon. And we loved the Star was the one that had, or was it Us that had Celebrities Are Just Like Us?
I think that's Us.
I think that's Us. Yeah, yeah. yeah I think that's yeah. Us Magazine. But I mean,
one of our older gay friends, not much older actually than us, but he just loves old Hollywood.
Sure.
And he really loves the magazine Closer.
Oh, Closer to the Grave?
Closer to the Grave, yeah.
Closer to the Grave, darling. Yep.
Yep.
I love Closer Magazine yep. because they put like front page headlines about like Lucy. Like, yeah. How is this, like, it's breaking news?
Yeah, she's been gone for over 20 years, yeah. And it's, like, breaking. This is, yeah, Lucille Ball's cat.
You got a somebody. New story? So is there something we don't know?
Or just to go into yeah. a deep dive of Sally Field and Burt Reynolds, like, uh-huh. relationship.
Yeah. They're like their 9-month relationship in the 70s. Like, okay.
we talked to their housekeeper and they gave us a story no one's ever heard.
Absolutely. Yeah. The housekeepers have the real story. Agador Spartacus.
You better be careful what you throw away.
Like Agador Spartacus.
Absolutely. So did he make up Spartacus because of the whole attache to Greece?
Or is that actually I bet his name? So. I wonder if it had to do with, you know, the film, obviously.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, very, very homosexual coded.
Yes, because they only really call him Agador until...
So there's no reference to Spartacus prior to, like, the dinner?
I think they only call him Agador before the dinner.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think when he opens the door, he says, "My name's Spartacus," and then Robin Williams screams, like, "Agador!" like, in the background, and they go, "Agador Spartacus." He likes being called both... His full name, yeah. So I think he just...
Well, and I mean, at that point in the 90s, everyone was very aware of the film Spartacus and what the undertones were. So I think that was just a very on-the-nose, you know, maybe the younger generations today would not get that. But it was just kind of using the name Spartacus was just a veiled, you know, theme of what the entire movie was anyway.
Right.
It could also be stage name, you know.
True, yeah. Yes. Well, we had just... Clueless had just come out, and there's a joke in there.
Spartacus.
Yes, he brought over some movies for us to watch. Some Like It Hot and Spartacus.
Spartacus. I forgot about that.
Yeah, Christian the gay character. He wants to watch Spartacus with Cher.
Yeah, he played Christian the gay character. In,
yes, I did.
An unauthorized musical parody.
Oh, love it. Okay, great.
It was very funny.
What were some of Christian's songs?
You were over the top, like dressed in all pink.
It's true.
And, love
it. We opened act two where she's like, "I have a date tonight," and then they play Barbie Girl.
Yeah.
Love it.
Oh my God.
Love it. Okay, so let's see. What have we not covered yet? I did want to talk about Diane Wiest's kind of portrayal, because usually I feel like Diane Wiest is kind of known as a very, like, motherly character, and she's playing that here.
Yeah.
But I think she gets to have some moments, especially with Gene Hackman, where she kind of has some moments with him where she's just like, "You got to get your shit together, man."
Oh, yeah. And her comedy chops, they're always so nuanced and so good. Yeah. She never seems too over the top. And you always know exactly who she is, no matter what movie she's in, including this one.
Yeah.
You know.
I love to see her as just like this right wing character. I think it's just kind of unexpected for us as viewers.
Kind of.
Maybe.
Yeah. Sure. Mm-hmm. Like her Barbara Bush.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally.
Her Barbara Bush.
I love how they reference the Bushes. The Bushes. Yes. And, yeah.
Jeb Bush down in Palm Beach. Yep.
Yeah.
I had to remind Pete that, like, oh, yeah, do you remember, like, Trump totally gooped Jeb Bush for running for office?
Oh, my God.
And it was
just kind of
was the beginning of the end.
But I was
that,
just like
you didn't hear anything about Jeb Bush after.
He could have run again this time. I don't know. Yeah, he just said, no, never again. I don't know. What do we know about the Republican race?
Do you think that something like the Coalition for Moral Order within the past few years with the Republican Party has ever been pitched and then it gets shot down, that they're like, oh, that's from the Birdcage? Like, we can't possibly sponsor anything like this.
Yeah. And then we're all going to make fun of it and they're just going to have to rename it.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
It's like that 1 million moms group. You know, is that what it is? Where there's actually only about 1,200 moms.
Yeah, the Million Mom March. It's like, it's like maybe 1,000. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
But yeah, the Coalition for Moral Order, like, that is so funny.
It's
biting.
Insane.
Yeah. And then it's just that thing of, oh, when he got caught with the. But when Gene Hackman is on the call and he's just like, he's dead.
Oh, yeah.
A prostitute. Underage. And it just keeps getting like crazier and crazier and crazier.
Yeah. But, and don't they say, and she's black?
And she's black.
Yeah. Oh my God.
That's the topper.
And they like whisper it even, you know?
Yeah.
Very much a sign of the times and politics at the time. And, you know, unfortunately, probably today.
But it's true. It's like you always see these lawmakers, these politicians getting caught with, you know,
always
sex workers and maybe same sex sex workers, and there are always these hardcore Republicans, and you know
they're always politicians or like evangelical preachers or something. It's insane. It's insane. Yeah. The lady doth protest too much.
Absolutely.
Usually,
if you follow Lady Bunny or Jackie Beat on social media, you'll find out exactly when this happens because they're always the first to post about.
Oh yeah, for sure.
about right wing like politician scandals.
Yes,
and
yes.
How. And but it wasn't a drag queen.
Oh yeah, I've seen a lot of those. That's so funny.
So I mean,
I wonder too. You know, I wonder with nowadays with everything going on with drag queens being villainized, mm-hmm. you know, by crazy right wing conservatives. I wonder what the kind of overall social climate was. Obviously, there weren't as many drag queens at this time, right? But there's. Of course, there was a stigma about it in the movie. That's why these reporters are following them and everything. So not just oh, they're gay, right. A gay couple, but there's one of them is a drag queen, right? And I wonder what the climate was like about people who were drag queens at the time, even though the numbers, I'm sure, were much less.
Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there's still kind of that stigma now. Like, you see it all the time, like drag queens, like, having trouble finding relationships because I think even, you know, in the gay community, there's just that like, oh, we love drag queens. Yes, fierce work. But like, would you date one? You know, and I think for a lot of gay men, it's still this hurdle that they can't get past, which is so crazy. Like, especially, like I said, we're so like not inundated, but drag has just become such a like part of gay community, right? And culture.
Yeah.
And it's still such a huge issue in our culture nation, you know, in the country, in the world, like anything, someone who identifies as a male that anything feminine touches it, people are irate. Like I wear a pair of booty shorts and I get 10,000 comments on something where people are fighting about it. And I'm like, you guys, it's just a pair of short shorts. If it wasn't denim, you wouldn't give a fuck.
Right.
If they were if they were gym shorts, it wouldn't matter.
To like, go jogging, you wear shorter shorts to fucking go run on the treadmill.
Right.
Shut up.
Yeah.
And, you know, also, I mean, just because drag queens are being so villainized and attacked by, you know, right-wing politicians right now, I don't know. I wasn't old enough to know what that would have, what the, like, not just within the queer community, what the, what am I trying to say? Not just in the queer community, like what the perception of drag queens was, but just in general, like at large, I wonder how people saw drag queens at the time.
Yeah. Well, I would imagine that there was probably confusion of, do you do this all day?
Okay. Well, that's something I wanted to talk about because, you know, if we are going to continue down the road of if this movie were made today, is Albert possibly a trans character? Are they non-binary? Right. I mean, clearly they're non-binary, right? But there's no language for that in 1996. But are they, they're not living, Albert's not living as a woman, right? But maybe they would be in 2024, right? So this is something that a modern telling of this, would we have to rethink our kind of perception of this character and our portrayal of this character?
Right.
Because Albert is just a little bit more than an effeminate man. You know,
because at one point too, I don't remember the exact line, but Albert says something about being a woman and Armand says, well, you're not a woman, right? Mm-hmm. And that's one of the lines I think that probably would not hold up nowadays. I don't know. I guess it would depend on that character and how the character wanted to be portrayed.
Right.
I don't know.
It's the introduction of Albert's character when he won't go out on stage and he says, oh, Armand, you're always right because you're a man and I'm a woman.
Yeah.
And he says, well, you're not a woman.
Yep.
You know, and the way he says it is kind of like, all right. It's a kind of interesting, like how we would go about this character today.
Mm-hmm. There's something
be interesting if it was just identified as non-binary.
Right.
All the challenges that come with that.
Yeah.
There's something that I noticed in this viewing that I've never really thought about these scenes, but there's something about Albert when he's doing the errands outside of the apartment early in the movie of that when he's walking on the street, like everybody knows Albert. Like, oh, that's Albert.
Yeah.
Like he has this little banter with like just, I mean, like the
lobster guy,
like the lobster guy, like where he gets like the cuts of meat of just the kind of seeing this character just very comfortable in their own skin.
Right.
Like, that's just something that in this viewing that I could really appreciate.
Yeah,
absolutely. Mm-hmm. Well, and, you know, I think that says a lot, too, probably about the state of the different, you know, gayborhoods, the kind of queer areas in the country at the time. Because, I mean, even for us now, unfortunately, like if we travel, we're both from states that are traditionally red for the most part.
Same.
You know, and if we go home, we are a lot more, you know, hesitant to hold hands walking down the street or even be affectionate with each other, even too jokey with each other in a way that might seem too familiar. And that's, you know, that's upsetting that that's still something that everyone has to deal with here in America.
When we're not home, we worry about safety.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Same with us. You know, Scott's from Montana and sometimes we'll take road trips and drive there, you know, and we have to go through Idaho. We have to go through like certain very, maybe a more Mormon state or a more, you know, fundamental, whatever. So sometimes I'm just a little like, and I'm brown. I'm just like, ooh, what's going
to
happen?
But you know, so it's nice to be able to see Albert's character walking about in public and being so appreciated, because I think that is the reality for so many queer people. And maybe back then, and you know, even today, I think that a lot of people need to see that kind of acceptance by just society in general and not just people, you know, behind closed doors in your own house, your friends and your close family, but just acquaintances and people that move about in the world.
I will say I do really, the farmer's market in Studio City, that when I see that scene, I relate to that. I have an olive oil stand. They know me and I know it. Them. I have a hummus stand. I love those bitches. There's a couple like certain stands. I'm always like, I have my little headphones and my booty shorts, and I'm walking around like, la, 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 flowers.
Garrett.
You know, Garrett, I'm glad you brought up something earlier. You know, you talked about your social media, and I feel like you do use your social media to maybe express some parts of your femininity on there, you know, with some of your videos and performances and your dancing and all that. And every now and then I will go into the comments and just look at it and be like, oh, shake my head. For the most part, they're great. And for the most part, they're positive. And I'm thinking, I hope he doesn't have to go through and delete a lot of these. You know, sometimes I will see that you post like duos with Montana.
Yeah.
The other dance. And I feel like on hers is where I'll see a lot more like weird kind of comments.
You know what? It varies per video, but I, you know, when I first started getting more into the content creation when the pandemic started or when the pandemic hit, because that's really where I got into a lot of this.
Yeah.
I used to go through the comments a lot more.
Yeah.
And then at some point I had to make peace with the fact that everything on the internet is polarizing, no matter how good your intentions are, no matter what you're putting up. I mean, you can be the most morally correct person doing the sweetest thing and someone's going to be mad about it.
Right.
Yeah. So at this point, I have a few rules of thumb I always follow. I never delete comments anymore unless it's like racist or hate speech.
Sure, yeah.
Outside of that, like if you have a negative opinion about me, people are going to, and I'm sure there's people who are either going to comment on that comment agreeing with you, or anybody who's from my community or an ally of it or a friend who feels like they have the need to defend me. Like all of those things, you're showing the algorithm that people are engaging with this.
True.
And you're making the numbers grow on my account. So thank you. And it's at this point, it's like, if you know, there's too many comments to filter through. Right. And so if you want to make my account grow, by all means. And secondly, if no matter how many negative comments there are, if my content gets more exposure and I get to express myself freely and I'm in a place where I can, there's other people who can't and don't get to live that way.
Yeah.
And if that for them gives them a moment of peace, knowing there are places in the world where you can express yourself freely without fear of getting hurt or shamed or made to feel worse or whatever comes with that. If it gives them a moment of relief to know that there's places in the world where you can just be who you are and you can say fuck anybody who doesn't like it, then by all means, I am happy to like rev the engine and just keep going forward. I don't know where it's going, but I'm having a lot of fun.
Absolutely. That's so great. That. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's such a good like way to think about things. And I hadn't even thought about that, but it's like, keep commenting and stay mad because that's engagement, baby.
I remember Aja mentioning that on her TikTok.
I never even thought about it that way.
Yeah. Well, it's like RuPaul saying, call me whatever you want as long as you're calling me.
As long as you call, yeah.
One, two, I even thought about, because we moved recently. We lived, in one part of the valley and moved just like 2 miles away to where we're living now just last year. And in August of last year, Laura Carlton, was shot because in Arrowhead, which is only about 45 minutes to an hour from here, because she hung a pride flag up in her shop.
Yeah.
And just outside this window behind us here on our balcony, we have a pride flag that's hanging up for everyone in our neighborhood to see. And, we talked about it and I was like, oh, I wonder if we should be worried about this. Is this something we need to consider? Should we take it down? Like, we don't want to be targets. But at the same time, yeah, I think it's not about us being like, hey, everyone, we're gay, but it's about for, those people who may not be in a position to be able to come out of the closet yet, young people who might be queer and who may not know that there are allies around and other people like them.
Or people in the area, if they come to this street, we want people who are, from different communities to know they're safe in this neighborhood. Or at least there's people in this neighborhood who are, have their eye out or on their side.
Right. Yeah. Right. I don't think there aren't many other people in our neighborhood who do have any sort of flag hanging anywhere. So we were like, maybe we should take it down. But at the same time, I was like, we don't want any assholes moving into this building anyway.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a good way for them to, if they're window shopping, to be like, oh, we don't want to live there. Keep moving. Keep walking.
Keep on moving.
Yeah. Oh, wow. All right. That's great outlook on all of that. And, that's the thing too. We have the title of our show is kind of makes people think two different things every now and then. A lot of people, for the most part, knock on wood, we've just gotten great feedback of, wow, your title's clever. We love it. Every now and then we'll get some cuckoo people that just start a comment. And I just think to myself, it's like,
they're all off Facebook's price.
Yep. The amount of effort that it takes for these people to think of something negative and to say, I'm going to open up my phone, go to your page, write something out and hit send. It's like, I don't know if I really want to further the conversation with this person anyway. So they're not keeping the lights on in this place.
Exactly.
They're not, their opinion of us doesn't matter. And so, I you have to have that attitude of just like, what we're doing is something positive. What we're trying to do, something positive, putting out good vibes into the universe and spread awareness. And, there's always going to be haters on everything.
Of course. And you know what you guys are doing too, is just you're giving fantastic art that makes people happy and, kind of has molded them into the people that they are in some sense anyway. You're giving it a new life and a new platform. I think that's fantastic. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thanks so much.
I've seen this line show up kind of circulating through gay Instagram accounts. But I mean, when I was watching it last night, there's something so biting about the line, especially, I mean, I'm not quite middle-aged. Like I'm still in my 30s, but still the line where Armand says, yes, I wear foundation. Yes, I live with a man. Yes, I'm a middle-aged fag, but I know who I am, Val. It took me 20 years to get here, and I'm not going to let some idiot senator destroy that. There's something so empowering about that line that I don't think really resonated with me until I got to my later half of my 30s.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's very powerful to be able to stand in your own truth, especially when the masses are against you.
Yeah.
And I think especially at that time, I mean, you could say that's even the case now, queer people are still in the minority. And that's fine. But when it's, when it feels like there are many other communities against you and they outnumber you, it can be really scary to stand there and be who you actually are. So yeah, that's always been a very, very strong line, I think.
I was thinking about it too, and I thought about what I said earlier about, I know this type of gay guy who's that age. And, for gay people in the 90s to make it to your 40s and later on, that in itself is like an accomplishment, right? We were at, we saw the Madonna concert 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Almost and, there. Yep. there's a portion where there's a big tribute to, you know, the AIDS epidemic.
And she's singing Live to Tell.
She's singing Live to Tell, and these images come up on the screen, and it starts with, you know, Keith Haring and all these people, and it just becomes, the pictures start getting smaller and smaller because there's more and more faces start coming up on the screen. And I am telling you, I'm sitting in the Great Western Kia Forum surrounded by 30,000 other gay homosexuals and straight women, bawling my eyes out, crying Niagara Falls. Like, it is so touching, and you just think about, or so moving, you just think about this, you know, gay men of a certain age. And in the 90s, they were in their 40s, and now they're in their 60s.
Yeah.
And they, yeah, maybe they are a little bit more flamboyant, and maybe they do wear flashy jewelry and, you know, and animal print. Yeah. You know, silk shirts and all that, but it's like they made it. Like they get to kind of show off who they are if they're still around, right?
And and let alone like Albert and Armand, they're business owners. Like they own this drag club, like
the damn beachfront
of just how much work that would have been for both of them to do.
Yeah.
And another thing that I kind of take for granted when watching this movie is when they're on the bus stop. He shows him that, like,
the palimony papers.
The palimony's papers, because it's like these two guys aren't married. So it's just like, if anything happens to one of them, what's going to become of their business? And those were very real conversations at that time, just because, I mean, you could have like maybe a civil union and have a ceremony, but there's not anything legally binding you to this person.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, only in the last decade or so is, you know, are we able to feel more secure in that way too? And I remember we talked about, you know, we've been together for 13 years now. And how long have you guys been together?
2010.
I was going to say 20. Yeah, about 13, 14 years now.
About the same. So, I mean, you know, when for the first few years that we were together, those were real concerns that we had as well, and things that we had to have many conversations about, like, oh, if something were to happen to me or if something were to happen to you, we want to be able to get into the hospital room if we need to, you know, and that's, it was a real concern. So I can't, you know, after, especially back then, and thinking about the context of this movie, when it was filmed and what it meant for gay people at the time, queer people, you know, after going through the AIDS epidemic, losing so many friends, you know, loved ones, and still being able to persevere, there is something about that generation that is so, you know, respectable it's in a way, it's very bittersweet because obviously they've gone through so much, but they've pioneered, you know, so much for the rest of us to be able to enjoy the rides that we do now, you know. And I think that there is some subtext in that unless you were probably alive at the time and kind of were going through this either alongside these as straight people alongside that community or as a queer person experiencing it or witnessing it, you know, I think that you may not be able to pick up on those, that kind of subtext and kind of the history that these two characters have had together.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. Yeah. These are all things that, you know, we've seen this movie several times throughout our life. And we just did this rewatch last night to, you know, to kind of have it fresh in our head. And it's just like so many things pop out at you.
Yeah. And when you see it. I mentioned, kind of the quieter moments that I really focused on this rewatch.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This is definitely one of those movies, like, because I used to watch this with my mom all the time growing up.
Mm-hmm. And we watch it at least once a year. Probably,
But I would say this is a really good example of the kind of movie that you watch when you're young and it's really fun.
Yeah.
But when you're older, you understand it.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Would Nathan Lane be nominated for Best Supporting Actor if this movie came out today?
I remember the awards conversation. The awards conversation, I want to say that they got a SAG cast. And I want to say Hank Azaria was nominated in supporting at SAG. Hold, please.
Nathan Lane would have definitely gotten nominated for this movie.
I think so. Yeah. Yeah.
And I also feel like this is another good testament because there's certain movies that no matter how long ago they were made, it always feels like it could come out at any time and be a great movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It might change a little bit. Some of the nuances might change some of the references, you know, that sort of. And I think it probably will be remade. I mean, we're seeing remakes all the time. Why don't we
yeah.
You know, continue to make the movies and make them more socially relevant.
Mm-hmm. I just need them to wait like 15 years so I'm old enough to fight for Nathan
Lane. Sure. It looks like Nathan Lane got a Golden Globe nomination.
Okay.
They put him in lead actor too. So he got he got the Golden Globe nomination over Robin, which is probably pretty cool. I mean, Robin I'm sure was very happy to give up his spot to Nathan. Yeah. And it looks like both Nathan Lane and Hank Azaria were nominated for the SAG in supporting.
Interesting.
Which is very cool.
Wow, that's awesome. Yeah.
Yep.
I'm glad, you know, I'm glad to know that it got, I mean, it did really well in the box office, right? Mm-hmm. So the budget was like $31 million. It ended up making $185 million just over that. So it obviously did really well. It had a lot of really relevant, powerful stars in it at the time. But I'm also glad that it seemed to, you know, get the social recognition that it needed to.
Could you imagine this coming out today, though? If a movie like this came out today, it would be so fascinating because some people, like, just because of what's going on in politics today, like, this would, with a cast of this caliber, it would create a huge, like, polarizing conversations, political things, some people boycotting, other people being like, we have to see it. Like, it would just be, it would be fascinating for something like this to come out.
Yeah, and it's kind of interesting that, I mean, I was a kid at the time that I don't really remember a lot of political upset about movies like The Birdcage or Tu Wong Fu. It's just like they kind of flew over the radar. Or, like, they flew under the radar.
I think at that time, it was just a little bit more, like, socially, like, oh, Patrick Swayze, like, how is he going to play this gay character? But now it is such this political issue. And how...
Yeah, now it's like, oh, they're trying to indoctrinate our children.
How now you can't even have any kind of, like, inclusive casting without people being like, they're shoving it down our throats.
Yes. Yeah. So how are we 30 years later, drag queens doing the same job that they've been doing all this time, yet we've, like, regressed so far to be so, like...
I think
legislation is being passed. Like, what?
Yeah, I think a lot of it probably has to do with, you know, I remember watching the first couple seasons of RuPaul's Drag Race right when it came out, mm-hmm. and now there have been so many seasons, and drag is it's the norm. You know, it's not something that is. I mean, yeah, it's still taboo, obviously, for certain communities, but it's out there, and
it's
more
normal than it's ever been.
It's more normal than it's ever been. That's right, and I think back then,
or I guess more. Visible.
I mean, yeah. I mean, it's made both Pete and I armchair experts about drag, but in the grand scheme of things, like, what do we know? Like, we know nothing.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's
but I think,
all, that
I think
all just comes
so
from that show.
More
yeah.
Pushback nowadays politically because it is the norm. You know, these people who have been, you know, these communities that have been undermined for such a long time and kind of oppressed are now seeing more of the spotlight and being put on stage. And that scares people who don't know that side of things because it's something that's different.
Well, they want to keep the status quo because they want to keep the power and the control and the conversation in their court.
Yeah.
But when you actually start including other people from other places, you don't get to control the narrative anymore, and that scares people. And you know what? Let's keep them fucking scared.
Right?
I mean, good luck getting RuPaul's Drag Race canceled. It's like, you know how many, like, franchises they have throughout the world? It's just like...
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Well, all stars upon all stars.
Well, and also, the ratings for that are better than 90% of TV shows today.
Yeah.
True.
Yeah.
Something interesting, though, that I read was, I guess Mike Nichols went on tour with his production designer, I think, or maybe production manager at the time, going to drag shows around the country.
I think it was Bo Welch. Yeah. They went to clubs in Chicago and probably even Miami when they were location scouting. Yeah.
Yes, yes. And I guess originally, because this does have French origins, the story, they were going to shoot it in New Orleans, which I think would have been a completely different movie.
Yes.
Oh, know? Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It would have worked.
And then they went to South Beach and they were like, oh, we should shoot it here. This is, and you know, I think that the decision to do that and move it from New Orleans, I think it was a good idea because it kind of took away the, you know, there's always, I'm from the South, I'm from Texas and grew up just a couple hours away from the Louisiana border. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of stereotyping and crazy shit that can go into that. Sure. And I think that focusing on a place that may not have been portrayed as much in cinema at the time was a good idea because you could really hone in on those characters a lot more, and it wasn't about the environment as much.
Yeah. No, yeah, absolutely. No, that makes perfect sense. But I do think that the location does lend itself so well to this movie. Just
absolutely,
like,
yeah, yeah.
You know, just the fact that it's set in this cabaret kind of an environment.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, there was something about being like a gay kid in the 90s with, you know, Blockbuster Video and having cable and just kind of really wanting content of any kind, right? Yep. And just kind of seeking it out. And then to see things like, okay, what is, you know, what's out there as far as like, you know, entertainment and when I get older, what can I expect? And I'm just saying, okay, drag queens, that looks fun. That looks like a good time. A cabaret is a little different. I mean, we're out here in LA. We don't really have too many of those kinds of drag shows. But
we used to until the venues closed.
Right. Yeah. Right. I mean, there were like piano bars and, you know, all that stuff in LA. Now it's, you know, now it is what it is. Yeah. But I remember being a teenager and kind of seeing drag queens and seeing this kind of thing in movies and just being like, okay, I think I can get behind this. This looks like fun. Lip syncing. All right. This looks like a good time. I do like that there's a lot of, I think they go over it a little bit more in To Wong Fu, and I think we talked about it a little bit here, but there's, for a general audience, a straight audience, just the American movie going public, they didn't really go into too much of, you know, straight men being, you know, transvestites, air quotes.
Well, I mean, they kind of show and they don't tell in this movie because their domestic life.
Yeah. And I think I think that's the director and the script just kind of lending itself so well to just a peek into these people and not necessarily having it be this like,
it wasn't the focus. Lesson. That aspect of it wasn't the focus. It was more the relationships and the humanity, you know, behind the individuals. It wasn't as much as like, oh, you know, Albert is putting on these, not a breastplate, but these like chicken cutlets putting on mascara and all that. That wasn't really talked about. It was being done in the background while we get to watch these people just live their lives.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And I think in other movies at the time, there was a lot of focus on kind of explaining that or feeling the need to kind of get all that. Yeah.
Or not feeling the need to have all of the drag characters in this movie be in drag for the entire movie, like you see in To Wong Fu and Thanks for Everything.
Yeah. Where they're fully living their lives as their drag character.
That's true. And I wonder, I wonder what the thinking was behind that. Did you? I'm sure you guys explored that a bit.
You know,
you haven't done that one yet, right?
We have the commentary, but that's a question that a lot of...
I think there's a lot of charm to that movie that they are in drag. It's like a maxi challenge on Drag Race, but it's a feature movie. So I think that there's charm to it.
Well, the whole thing that doesn't make sense is that they're like running from this police officer and, you know, they're hiding their identities. Just get out of drag,
why not,
girl?
Just take off our drag?
Take the wig off. They won't know who you are. Movie ends. Credits.
It's something that Priscilla explores a lot more, too.
Yes. Yep. Yes. And I think Priscilla, I think, does it in such a smart way, too, because, you know, you have these three characters that are drastically different in age and experience, and they, you know, they have very complicated backgrounds, right? They all have very different relationships with drag and how the community has embraced them over time. And it's interesting in that movie, too, because for a lot of that movie, those three characters are kind of isolated together. They are the main focus. Yeah. With To Wong Fu, you bring in this kind of, you know, cast of other characters who are great, but you don't get the focus as much on what it's like to really live a life as someone like that in a genuine way, it feels like.
Yeah, yeah. And like Scott was saying, this movie does such a great job of just showing us as the audience and not having to dictate a lot of rules that are set up of just like, well, drag queens are this and trans people are this and transvestites are this. And they're just like, this is Starina, right? This is her. Like, this is this person and her experience.
Yeah.
And that's what we're getting, you know?
Good job of not making it an after school special.
I would imagine.
We're stuck in family drama.
Yeah. I would imagine that for an audience in 96, the first reveal of Val that it's faked out that you think Val's a younger man. You think he's the boyfriend. They've sort of been alluding to, who is he chilling this white wine for? Yeah.
Yeah.
Which, and then also mind blown for a 96 audience, it's his son.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Very true. And the fact that the name is Val, I remember, I think right. I remember the first time watching it thinking that it was probably going to be a female.
A woman, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
When they start mentioning Val and they're talking about Val, but then you see this kind of handsome younger man walk in who happens to be his son. Yeah, that was something that I don't think I'd ever really seen portrayed in film at the time.
I mean,
this was one of my first forays probably into watching any sort of movie with outwardly queer characters.
Right. People are always assuming also like, oh, you're two, you know, gay men raising a boy. He's probably, you know, going to be gay.
Right.
But it's two gay men or a queer couple raising a cis hetero man.
Yeah.
Totally. They do spell it out a little bit for us in the scene with Christine Baranski where they're reminiscing and he's just like, oh, and I got drunk and then I thought, why not give it a try and all that. But, you know, there's plenty of gay men who live their life as gay men and exclusively are with men but have kids. It's a thing. Yeah. It's a thing.
I mean, they still kind of show a little bit of his fluidity when they're kind of being coquettish again and she's...
He seemed pretty into it.
Yeah.
His insane chest and knuckle hair that he's always had.
That's Robin. Yeah. But I mean, it's absolutely a thing. I've known plenty of gay men of a certain age that have kids. So okay.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
But I think that's kind of maybe that's for the audience, just in case people are like, "What? How does he have a kid? Like this doesn't line up in my brain." It's like, well.
Well, and you know, I think it's nice to show. It's nice to show that because I think up until maybe not up until that point, I'm sure there were other instances too that I haven't thought about. But I'm sure that for a lot of people, this is probably the first time them experiencing a gay man having a child with a woman in that way that wasn't through a surrogate or adoption or what have you. You know,
and the mom is the one that kind of checked out. She's just like, this really isn't for me.
Yeah,
keep the kid.
Interesting.
Yep. Even though if Christine Baranski was my mom and she was local, I think that I am like trying to get a job at that PR firm
or fitness whatever she's doing there. It was a fitness thing.
I think it's a fitness company.
Yeah. I thought it was a PR firm.
No. Because it was like the pictures on the wall were all like people. Yeah.
But that was also very of the time. So who knows? It could have been a PR firm with just lots of nudes on the wall.
She just has a very Samantha Jones like energy about her.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, that huge
absolutely.
Yeah. That shot though, where she's stuck in traffic, and
there's a lot of work to get that shot.
Yeah. The bridge is lifting, and the one little sailboat's going through. It's such a funny visual gag, but it's like that's Christine Baranski sitting in that car.
Yep.
Like that that's a lot of work. That is a Mike Nichols. This is a movie, darling. Like we are stopping traffic and putting this movie star in this Mercedes on this bridge to get this helicopter shot. But it's a really funny visual gag. Like it works so well.
And she has the sunglasses. I think she has doesn't she have like a scarf?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, I love later on when she calls to say that she's late and Val like intercepts the phone call and he hangs up and, you know, is talking to Robin Williams, to Armand. And he's like, she was on her car phone. There's no way you can call her back.
Another sign of the times.
I was like, oh, there's not.
I also really like how the song or the song We Are Family bookends the movie.
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that also thematically sends a very pointed message. And I remember for whatever reason, my family when I was growing up was very into that song. Like whenever we would hang out at holidays and stuff, it would be playing and everybody was singing. So
always
that
gets the party going.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's probably true.
Yeah.
Well, even how that's true. I mean, I get that we get sort of like the credit scene of them in the church, but I mean, you get that epic like camera zoom going into the club, which how that scene is cut is kind of beautiful because it just cuts and you don't even think about
it. Just getting into a little like movie making filmmaker inside baseball weeds. This movie is shot by Emmanuel Lubezki.
Ah, Chivo.
Chivo.
I forgot that Chivo shot this movie.
Academy Award winning director. He won several times,
I mean, he won like three Oscars in a row for like the Revenant, for The Revenant and Birdman.
Gravity? Did he win for Gravity?
In Gravity.
He works a lot with Mexican directors. But he and he's from Mexico, but he is a prolific director of photography. He shoots these movies like nobody else. You know you're watching a Chivo movie.
That he shot this movie.
And this movie opens on a helicopter shot over the ocean that zooms into across the street and into the bar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how it somehow in the
cuts
hell,
it somehow cuts when they're going across the
how
street.
How in the hell yeah. in 1996 they just yeah. even if it wasn't the helicopter to a crane. The crane yeah, from
pre,
outside
pre drones, pre AI, yeah. all yeah. of that stuff.
No, that is a massive that's a massive crane. You get all you get that big thing up there
yep.
and then it's like you're flying in the sky yeah. and then you're zooming into the building.
It's, and it's like over the ocean.
It's so yeah. be, it's a beautiful,
I don't know how they did it.
And but it's
shot.
But it's also not conspicuous.
Yeah.
It's not flashy
overly flashy.
Or showy. You're just like, oh, cute, and now we're in the bar. But you're like, wait a minute, it hasn't cut
how did we
at
get
all.
Here?
Yeah.
It's so good.
It but almost yeah. reminds me of the opening shot of like Romeo and Michelle.
Yep.
When they're yes. out of the ocean yes, and yes, yes. zoom in and it's playing
yeah.
I'm Just a Girl mm-hmm. and goes into that famous Venice apartment building, you know?
Yes.
And then yeah. And then when they're exiting the club and they're getting into Christine Baranski's car, it's like the yeah. it starts backing up. So it's like we're entering
yeah.
the birdcage and now we're leaving it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's also yeah. a really good single take that's a walk and talk with I think with Armand and Albert, isn't it?
Yeah, it's when they're walking down the street.
Yeah,
I love all the extras in that scene.
Yeah, and they don't cut at all. And they're walking, and people are looking at them because they're being Albert and Armand, and people are walking by and coming in and out of frame, and yeah. all this business in the background.
Women in like G-string thongs, yeah, guys yeah. in Speedos. yeah,
and but it's another one that you're just watching it going. They haven't cut in a while, and they're getting spitting yeah. out dialogue, talking like all the business, this like Sesame Street background going on, and it just kind of shows that this is a very well made movie. There's like
absolutely. I mean, yeah, I think anytime you have like a one shot that lasts for as long mm-hmm. as it does, it's great because it allows you to stay in the scene,
yeah.
and it speaks so much to what's going on behind the camera and mm-hmm. with the camera, obviously, and just the performances on camera too.
Yeah.
They're able to hold it for so long and to organically be in these characters that it brings you in and it endears you to them that much more.
Yeah. Yeah. Just really quickly, we were, the very beginning, right after We Are Family, and her mom's like, where's Starina? Like her number's next. And all this stuff. And I'm just like, It's Drag Night,
it's
darling.
Drag. Everything runs late.
Play another song.
Oh yeah,
just move somebody's number up.
I feel like that is very typical. We were at a party last night, and there was a drag queen there, and we were talking about how drag queens are always late to everything.
Oh yeah, yeah.
But how could you not be? There's a lot of prep that goes into that.
There's a lot of prep. I mean, and that's the thing about drag shows too. It's like, a lot of the times these girls are coming in, it's a tip gig, they're getting paid maybe $50 and whatever money people throw at them, sweaty yep. dollar bills. We've seen hosts at a drag show go behind a curtain so that yeah. they can announce themselves
yeah.
and then yeah. come out, and welcome to the stage.
They're not given like the star dressing room.
Yeah. This is something that you're just out there, you're hustling, you're making money. But this The Birdcage in South Beach, this is a professional production.
It's proper.
They've got numbers. They've got choreography.
Oh, yeah. Like a Vegas review almost.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. It's a review. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I'm coming at it from this like East Hollywood, Highland Park, like down and dirty drag show where they're just like announcing themselves and getting ready in the men's room,
Starina's a goddamn professional.
She absolutely is. And she's a star.
She wouldn't have it any other way.
It's right there in her name.
Something that I noticed in this viewing is that when Starina comes back on, so she goes and does the number. When she comes back on, I just made Pete watch the section of A Star Is Born with Judy.
Yes.
That I'm just like, oh, this is like some of the best acting of Judy Garland's like career, and she's in like the sad hobo clown,
the hobo makeup,
and
it's from A Star Is Born.
Yeah, when he walks in, that's what she's wearing.
Yeah,
is that?
Oh, I never realized that.
Yeah,
yeah.
That's crazy.
So it's just kind of this like Judy sadness.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's interesting too because I think there are so many. I mean, obviously, so many references and kind of Easter eggs that are all mm-hmm. these queer. Like, homage to all these queer icons and movements and mm-hmm. everything. It's a really awesome film that it builds those things in so naturally.
Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. totally.
Costumes in this movie done by Anne Roth.
Anne Roth.
Yep.
Okay.
Oh. Icon.
Anne Roth from Barbie.
Yep. She's the lady on the bus stop in Barbie.
Yeah. Oh,
she didn't design the costumes for Barbie. She's the woman at the bus stop in the Barbie movie. Yeah.
She says, I know it. That's Anna Roth. She did the costumes for this movie.
You're so beautiful. I know it.
Yeah. That's amazing. I did not know that connection. That's really cool, though.
Oh, she's like an icon in the costume. She's like an industry legend. Like, she works regularly with, like, Nicole Kidman, Meryl Streep. It's like, name a huge actress working in Hollywood, and Anna Roth has probably done many of their costumes.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, and the costumes in this movie are amazing, too. I mean, obviously, the setting has a lot to do with, right, like, Armand suits and everything, and then you have the whole drag element with all the different costumes and outfits. But yeah, I mean, every scene is pretty eye-catching in that way.
I still love that Starina outfit, the one that looks like Barbara in the opening of Funny Girl.
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. When is she wearing that?
Seth?
When she... on stage, right?
Is it when she first comes out?
In the opening.
Yeah,
you're talking about the big headpiece?
It's the whole thing. There's like the thing around the shoulders.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
And the hat, it gets a the whole moment.
It's blue, isn't it?
That's great. I feel like the drag costumes are really good, but I think that they're just kind of day-to-day looks are really, like you were saying, it's indicative of the location, the setting, but also these two characters, you know, Albie's costuming is just so perfect of, like, you know, him as this flamboyant, like, gay drag artist, you know, like, wearing these flowy. It's a little, you know, Dorothy's Bornak adjacent, but hey, I'll let it go.
Well, they were in the same county.
There you go.
Pete.
Yes.
Kevin Alexander is a Goldman girl. Kevin is somewhere in drag in this movie.
Kevin Stay from Madonna's, Blonde Ambition Tour.
Very famous movie dancer. I mean, he's in, like, Austin Powers. He's in Showgirls. I just saw him posting from the Madonna Palm Springs show earlier this week. Yep.
Yeah,
he should have him on.
I would love to have Kevin Stay on our show.
We're going to see Showgirls at the Academy Museum on Wednesday, so maybe he will be there.
Because he posted. He's in Showgirls. That's right.
Yep, because he's in Showgirls. He's one of the main featured dancers in Goddess.
I love that. We yell different places all the time.
Different places. I mean, how do you like that? It's like that movie is being showed at the Academy of Motion Picture and Science Museum.
That is pretty
and
crazy.
Elizabeth is
so
introducing
snubbed.
It. It's just sort of what like
well,
a cool
fun fact. It completely out like whatever it did at the box office didn't matter. What it did for the DOV and industry, like it revolutionized it because people ordered so many VHS tapes of that movie specifically.
Oh wow, I love that. That's vindication for Elizabeth Berkeley, like, come on.
Well, if she saw any of the money, I guess it is.
Yeah, that's true. That's
hopefully
true.
Hopefully she did.
Well, she'll be there. When are we going?
Wednesday.
Wednesday. She'll be there Wednesday when we
nice.
Go to the screening. So
we'll
say hi.
Have you guys done that movie?
We
did. Of course.
Yes,
yep.
We did.
We had a real world guest on it.
Oh.
We had Dan Renzi.
We had Dan Renzi from the Real World Miami.
Listen, Dan Renzi from the Real World Miami, who got into a fight with Melissa from the Real World Miami because he was working for a magazine at the time and she opened up his mail and it was slides from the Birdcage that he was writing an article on. And they got into this huge fight. And he goes, "Well, did you open that envelope?" And she goes, "Yeah." And he goes, "What's in it?" And she goes, "Slides from the Birdcage." And he's like, "What? Why did you open my mail, you stupid bitch?" And she
went off.
And Melissa was Cuban, and she lost her mind. She was like, "Do not call me a bitch." And it was a huge fight. It lasted two episodes. And it was about slides from the bird.
I forgot about that. That's funny. I'm glad that
it was hilarious.
And it was Dan Renzi, and he is the guest on our Showgirls episode. So
Full circle
moment. How about that? Yeah. And let me tell you this. Dan Renzi can talk. That episode was 2.5 hours long.
Oh my gosh. Well, but also, you know, the source.
Yes, it was Showgirls.
There's a lot to unpack there.
We can talk about Showgirls.
That was
a long night.
An episode recorded in the dark days of the pandemic too. Yes. And he was working as a nurse in the time.
So,
go back and listen to that episode.
He did talk for about half an hour.
Dark times.
He did talk for about half an hour about being a nurse and COVID and everybody like stay home and all that. He gave the whole like stay home, do what you got
to
do.
That episode has to be a trip to go back for just listeners going through the catalog now.
Yeah, it was wild
times.
It will
be probably referenced historically because,
I mean,
you know, it seems so weird that was only four years ago now. That almost 4 years ago in a month that we shut down. Not even. It's been
It was March. It was March 13th.
It was 4 years ago because I work at TJ's, and we were just talking the other day. I was just like, yeah, I think it was about 4 years ago this week that it was like
it was March 13th,
a bomb went off at our job.
Yeah.
And it wasn't the same for like 2.5 years.
Yep.
It seems like it was so much longer ago, but really scary times. I can't imagine being a nurse at that time.
Yeah, it was a wild conversation. So listeners, if you're interested, go back back
absolutely.
In the archive.
I'm sure it's really interesting.
It's a fun episode because Dan was really great. He's a very fun person, and his conversation with Showgirls was great. But the COVID stuff was also interesting. So
yeah.
At any rate, do we have any final thoughts on The Birdcage besides recommending people to just go out and watch it?
One of my favorite lines of this movie that I think about all the time. It's a very minor comedic line of this movie, but I think about it a lot. Live on Fisher Island, die on Palm Beach. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also, don't forget the How Egyptian, where Albert's about to go, Albert's in a mood and about to go to, I don't remember the name of the city he's going to mm-hmm. or the beach. And he's like, oh, the only thing there is the cemetery. Oh, you're taking your toothbrush? How Egyptian. I mean, that's such a clever line. There's so many good one-liners in this movie.
Yeah. That almost sounds like a Robin Williams ad-lib.
Oh, and
I wonder.
And I think that there was a lot of improv in this movie. I mean, when you're working with Robin, you kind of just have to submit to Robin's improv, and why wouldn't you? And the big iconic
dance rehearsal
scene. I think that Robin just came up with that on the spot. Like, it wasn't scripted. He just did it.
Marsha Graham. The amount of footage they have from Mrs. Doubtfire, they said they have enough to make an entirely extra movie.
Love it.
I'm ready for the NC-17 version of Mrs. Doubtfire.
They have a whole rated R version of that movie, and I need it.
Oh, they need to release it. Come on, cowards.
We need to make friends with Chris Columbus. I'm sure he has Mac.
I hope so.
Yep. I think they said somewhere something about having a cut or something like that of it being like...
It exists. It's somewhere. Yeah. Oh, we love it. We love it. Boys, do you have any final thoughts on the movie that we want to get out?
I don't know. I just know it's going to be something that we revisit at least once a year. And the dinner scene is always a major highlight for me.
Oh my God.
I mean, it's it's probably over 30 minutes is that entire section of the movie.
It's almost the entire, the first half of act three, I think, is the entire dinner scene, I think.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. Yeah, listeners, just do yourself a favor. Like you two, we watch this movie fairly regularly. We're going to be watching it again soon just because it's so much fun to get to. Yeah. Listeners, go out and watch it. Blake and Garrett, thank you so much. This has been a lot of fun.
Thank you so much. It's good to have you back on, Blake, and I'm glad that we got you on the show, Garrett.
Yeah, this is so much fun.
And for such an iconic movie that you brought us on for. Thank you.
Yeah.
I know. I feel so honored.
Yeah. Garrett, we talked a little bit about your socials. Do you want to talk about where listeners can look you up if you care to spread the word on your socials?
Sure. You can find me, Garrett Clayton 1, on all platforms.
Yeah.
Awesome. Oh, easy. I love it. I love it when you get all platforms.
He's just started a new game show that we just launched about 2 weeks ago that you can find on YouTube and Facebook. And it's called V Games, Viral Games. And it's kind of like a nostalgic, Nickelodeon Double Dare meets Jackass situation. So only a few episodes up so far, but it's all the guests are your favorite, content creators, actors, influencers, entertainers.
Hosts.
Yeah.
Dancers, singers, you name it. It's a very wide range of guests we have, but it's a wild ride, and it's a lot of fun.
Yeah,
awesome. It's called V Games.
Yeah,
yeah.
All
go check it out.
Yeah, let's look it up, listeners. We'll look it up ourselves.
Yeah, it'll be fun.
All right, boys. Well, thank you so much for coming on one more time. We'll let you go. Have a great rest of your weekend.
All right. Thank you. Yeah, please let us know if you ever want to do it again. There's so many amazing movies that made us all gay.
Yeah,
totally. And thanks so much for listening, everybody.
I can't believe we finally got to it. We finally got to the Birdcage episode. What a fun combo.
Yeah. Fun movie to watch. And Blake and Garrett, you guys did such a great job on the show. So listeners, I hope you enjoyed that one. That was a lot of fun once again. But I think it's about that time in the episode. It's time for... Patreon shout-out. I want to say hello and thank you so much to all of our active patrons over on the Patreon, including, let's see, Courtney, Christina, friends at How Do You Drew, Andy, Kate, Pep, Tammy, Roberto, Brett, Daisy, Kelly, Christy, Stephen, Desiree, Laura, Thomas, Lori, Brenna, Jessica Rabbit, Lawrence, Lisa, Alexis, Thomas, Mary, Ted, Benny, Jermel, Melanie, Nicole, Susan, JJ, Shelby, Paul, Jamie, Drew, Genevieve, Dawn, Joshua, Aaron, Nick and Shannon, Christine, and Rufino. You guys,
thank you so much.
Thank you so
much. We have
a
lot of fun stuff going on the Patreon these days.
Indeed.
When you join at the $5 level, you will get the television that made us gay, that you'll get one episode a month of us talking about a television show. Our last month's episode, February, we did The Simpsons.
Yes, indeed.
We talked about a Marge-centric episode of The Simpsons that is one of our favorites. And so you'll get that at the $5 level. And then at the $10 level, you will get our Watch With Us commentaries.
Yes, indeed.
And there will be new episodes out around the time this one comes out.
Yes, indeed. So with Watch With Us commentaries, we've got about 40 of those. With The TV That Made Us Gay, there's a bunch of new ones coming out. And, you know, if we do a show that you like, listen, we could do an entire second podcast just about the facts of life.
Yeah.
We're going to have to pick and choose some really great episodes, but we'll go back to the well for shows.
When we start our podcast network, we'll do our facts of life podcast from the very beginning.
Yeah. But there's tons of stuff over at patreon.com/moviesthatmadeusgay. And, you know, for $1 a month, we give you a shout-out on the show, just like all of our friends there. So check it out. And all the donations go directly to keeping the show up and running on the air every Friday with no commercials, ad-free. So,
but you know what is free? Is to write a nice review on iTunes,
yes,
and to give us 5
indeed.
Stars. We would love that.
We were talking about engagement before. Any engagement really helps. You know, liking comments, sharing posts, writing a comment, all that stuff really helps the engagement and gets our show and our socials really up and running. But if you have Apple Podcasts, if you have an iPhone, Apple Podcasts is included already. You got to delete it yourself manually, because otherwise it's there. So search Movies That Made Us Gay, hit the 5 stars, write us a review if you're so inclined, and we'll read it on an episode. We haven't had a review since December, you guys, or maybe January. So write a new review. And on Spotify, you can leave a 5-star rating as well. So do that. And speaking of socials, we are at Movies That Made Us Gay on Instagram. We're most active on Instagram.
Yeah, Instagram, Facebook.
Yep. We're on the, you know, Twitter-esque, X, Blue Sky, all those.
Most active on Instagram.
But we're most active on Instagram, so follow us there. If you want to follow our personals, you can do that as well. Feel free. My name's Pete. I'm at Peter Lasagna on Instagram and Twitter. And you're Scott.
Scott Youngballer on Instagram, and follow my Letterboxd.
Yes, indeed. Follow Scott's Letterboxd. I watch the same movies as him practically, almost all of them. There are some that I haven't seen yet. I didn't watch The Society of the Snow, too real. But for the most part, his Letterboxd is good to go. So check us out. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. We'll be back next week. Bye.